Hello, I'm Mike. I'm an alcoholic. I've been asked to read this. This is from page 100 from our book. Both you and the new man, or woman, must walk day by day in the path of spiritual progress. If you persist, remarkable things will happen. When we look back, we realize that the things that came to us when we put ourselves in God's hands were better than anything we could have planned. Follow the dictates of a higher power, and you will presently live in a new and wonderful world, no matter what your present circumstances. I'd like to introduce my new friend from Sulphur Springs, Texas, Gary Kincaid.
I want to make sure I don't get Tim's water. Well, good evening, folks. I think my home group has been praying hard for years that I would get laryngitis. I think there's something in y'all's air, but I'll tell them it's not going to work. They get so tired of me, they won't even let me lead the silent prayer half the time. But I am an alcoholic. My name is Gary Kincaid. And I am really, 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 really grateful for a sobriety date and for a new life. Mine started July 25th of 1994. That'd be applauding y'all. Started in Odessa, Texas, in West Texas, and today I live in a little town east of Dallas, Sulphur Springs. And I'll tell you a little bit more about that in a moment. First of all, Mike, thank you for the invitation, and Mike, thank you for your hosting. It's been a fun time. I love these things. I would say to you new folks, or to any of you that have, if you get a chance to tell your story, do it. I love to tell my story. Not because I love to hear myself talk, which I'm accused of from time to time, but I love to hear over and over and over again what's happened to me and what continues to happen to me as the direct result of the 12-step program of Alcoholics Anonymous. The gentleman that got the big book, congratulations. You were just handed what may be the most underutilized resource in all of Alcoholics Anonymous. They took me to a conference when I was about 10 days sober. I remember two things of that whole weekend about what was said, but I do remember the Al-Anon speaker saying that she had a new sponsee and her husband was new in AA, and her sponsee says he's going to meetings, but he keeps stealing my money out of my purse. What should I do? And she said, it's pretty simple. Just put your money in his big book. It's the last place he'll ever look. Now, I've heard many of you one-on-one this weekend say something like, you're a speaker. There are no big shots in AA. But every one of us is somebody in AA. There's nothing special. I never want to be known as a speaker. I'm a member of the New Life group of Alcoholics Anonymous in Sulphur Springs. I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous who, on occasion, I lost my sponsor of 28 and a half years about a year ago. And Steve used to say, Gary, the only reason you get to do this, it's because you've got a fairly average 15-minute story with the ability to stretch it into an hour. He also told me when you go to one of these things, they're going to give you a set of the tapes. That's how long ago that was. He said, don't listen to them. Mail them to me. And if I ever hear one of your talks worth you listening to, I'll mail it back to you. I never got one back, so. The speaker, I'm just like the rest of you. I get up every morning and put my teeth in just like everybody else does. You know, there's nothing special about any of us. I want to thank the other speakers. I'll probably do some of that crosstalk because different things came up and it reminds me of things. One of those is, I'm glad you Al-Anons are here. I got sober in West Texas where they were all big book Al-Anons. A lot of times you'd want to go to the Al-Anon instead of the alcoholic because you're going to get the same resource of the big book. And the Al-Anon would usually give it to us in about 5 minutes where it took the alcoholic a couple hours. So if you wanted to save a little time, you could go to the big book Al-Anon. I do tell a story because I like to get y'all on my side. How many members of the Al-Anon family group do we have? Glad you're here. Do you know how to tell the difference between an alcoholic and a U.S. savings bond? Eventually, the bond matures. We've had living proof of that from this table here today. By the way, Tim, I'm going to depend on you, or as Ron would say, Timmy, I'm going to depend on you to signal me when I'm down to about an hour left, okay, so I won't go over with these folks. If I could, and I can't explain it unless you know it, I would say how grateful I am to the Al-Anon family program. I didn't know it till after I got sober. But my mother got in Al-Anon 2.5 years before she was killed by a drunk driver in 1988. And looking back, which is the only way I could do it, I saw my mother stop sending money when I needed money. She stopped staying at home all the time because Gary might call, "Where's Gary?" She started traveling again. She started going to see my brother and her grandkids. I am so grateful to the program of Al-Anon that my mom found her freedom, even though her kid was still drunk and running the streets. And if you're new to that family, the Al-Anon family, and you think that can never happen, it can, and it does all the time. Now, people tell me that I go all over the place when I'm telling my story, like there's something wrong with that. And I tell them, do you realize who I'm talking to? Our minds can kind of pick that stuff up. But I am going to have a shorter time today, so I want to say one thing that all of the speakers have talked about, at least to me, and I thought about it with this group and with you new people. How many of you at your first conference here? I'm going to make you a promise. And since I quit getting married so much, I don't make many promises anymore. And that should not be funny in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. If it's happened to you, I tell folks, in AA, if you've been married a lot, after 3, you don't have to give the number. You can just say several. And that's true of going to prison, DWIs, getting fired. None of those things make me or you an alcoholic. But I'll make this promise, the most important one of these days that you'll ever attend will be next year. And I'll promise you, if you'll come back next year, and if you will bring someone new with you, I don't know what your year is going to look like, but I can guarantee it'd be a hell of a lot better than last year. And the chances of you staying sober are going to go up about 500%. If you quit looking for what's going to make you feel good, what's going to make you happy, If you get busy trying to help someone else, this thing will begin to work and work immediately. You know how long you have to be here, new folks, before you start working with others? About 30 minutes. About 30 minutes. And you've heard the stories. You walk over to someone that looks like they're more afraid or more lost than you are, and you stick out your hand and you give a name and you get a name and you say, here, come sit with me. And you can start that from day one. It will change your life and it'll change theirs. And for those of us that have been here for a while, one of the other things, before I get into my story, my day came on July the 24th of 1994. And I'll say a little bit about that in a moment. But the next morning, I knew I was going to have to talk to somebody, and I drove over to that man's office. But on the way over, I stopped, and I'm broke. God Almighty, I'm always broke, broke, broke. But I stopped and bought a cup of coffee and a $1 scratch-off. And I didn't think about this for years, but I believe from the bottom of my feet to the top of my head, that if I'd gotten a $10 winner that morning, I never would have made it to Joe's office. That horrible emotions, that feeling of, and the knowledge suddenly of the loser I was, that incomprehensible demoralization, $10 would probably have taken care of it. Now, why'd I share that with you? It's been my experience that's where every real newcomer, that's the thread that's so slim that each of us hangs by when we walk through that door for the first time. They don't know that this is a chronic, progressive, fatal illness. They don't know that this really is, we have a lot of fun, but it's about life and death. They don't know, like I didn't know, how sick I really was. But we know. And that's why I'm so glad I got taught to always keep an eye on the door. Any place I go, my home group, your home group, when we were in Vancouver, wherever I'm at, it's my job to walk up to people and to greet them and to meet them and give them a number, get theirs. And people, we call them. I don't know where this stuff comes in that, well, if you really want it, you'll come get it or you'll call me. Read that book you got. Every place in our literature where there's a new person and a sober member of AA, the sober member of AA approaches the new guy. We don't wait for them to approach us. I'm so grateful that when I got a sponsor that first week, he didn't say, well, I want you to call me every morning at 6 o'clock. He called me every morning at 6 o'clock. He signed a couple of his pigeons, and they called me. I was being taken to two or three meetings a day. I didn't ask for rides. They showed up at my front door. After about 2 weeks, Jerry called me up one day and he said, Gary, I want you to hang up and call me back right quick. And I did. He said, do that again. And I did. He said, now see, you can do that. I want you to start calling me every morning, Dad. And that's what I've done with people for the 30 years and 8 months that I've been sponsoring people. I call them. Look around the room for a moment. Just look at each other. If you're new here, I'll tell you what my sponsor told me. By looking at these folks, we've got good news and bad news. The good news is you just looked around at your new best friends. And the bad news is you just looked around at your new best friends. This is it. This is who we're with. Now, you've heard some folks this morning, some great stories. Mine's not going to be like that. But take a look again at the people in the room. Think about the stories that you've heard this weekend and stories you hear in every meeting you go to. People, Hallmark would not make a movie out of your life or my life. They wouldn't make a movie out of what these two gentlemen, all four of you, have shared about. They'd say, that's too hokey. Nobody's going to believe that. That's unbelievable. And yet if I and perhaps you are not real careful, I can get to where I take that for granted. That we're in a room full of people every time we go to one of these meetings who just damn near missed it. We all nearly missed it. And I want to know that about every new person that walks in the room, because they don't. I was 47 years old when I got here. I can tell you a little what I was like raised in West Texas. My dad was a roughneck in the oil field. He was an alcoholic. My mother, I know today, was what we would call an untreated Al-Anon. I was a mama's boy. I was scared of my dad. I was ashamed of my dad. And I loved my dad. And it's only in these rooms that people can understand that. I was an only child, and I have an older brother. When I grew up, he wasn't part of the picture. One of the great gifts of recovery is for the last 31 years, my brother has had a brother. I always had one. Today, he's got one. That wasn't something that I was looking for, but that's a gift that came my way. I was the first person in my family to go to college, big extended family. Went to Texas A&M long time ago. It was a male-only military college then. My junior year, I met and fell in love with a beautiful young lady back home. In church. As a kid growing up, that MYF group was my safe place. Loved it. We got married in my first senior year. I got, took the LSAT, got accepted for law school at SMU. We went down to look that over, and for some reason, while I was there, I went by the School of Theology and ended up skipping law school and going to Perkins School of Theology, where I'm going to be a Methodist pastor for the next 14 years. That wife loved that. I love, nobody gets treated better than a Methodist pastor. We were married 7 years, gifted with children. I have twins, a son and a daughter. Which I wanted twins. I couldn't stand being pregnant twice. It was too hard on me. When I got sober, I didn't have any of the photographs or anything from my past. I'm a drunk that would just get up in the middle of the night and leave wherever I was. And all that stuff I would have told you meant everything to me. The children's baby shoes, diplomas, they were just left. My brother had some photos, and he's got one of where I was selected as one of the 5 outstanding young pastors in the state of Texas. I became at that time the pastor that got a 1,000-member church quicker than any other had done in our area. I was full of myself, but I was on a path. Life was absolutely fantastic. I got certified as an individual and family therapist. I'm a pastor. I'm a therapist. Got members at a couple of country clubs. The church pays for those. I'm on all kinds of civic boards. And life's going on. And on July the 25th of 1994, had I had any of those things, I could have papered one of these walls with college diplomas, including advanced degrees. If I added license, professional license, and certifications, it would almost fit. If I added marriage license, we'd have needed another wall. And if you can visualize that, and on each diploma and on each license, just exit out. One by one by one by one, I was fired from all of those things. The Methodist Church and I came to a grave misunderstanding. I could not keep my lips off of whiskey and women. And that just didn't work well in that profession. By that time, being a therapist went from certification to license, and they felt the same way about that behavior. There's a word I hear sometimes in meetings that I hope you'll get rid of, and that's the word denial. We are so far beyond denial, it's not even funny. The Big Book has a much better word to describe our condition. It's called delusion. We're nuts. See step two. We're crazy. One of the things I did when the state licensing board called me in to confront me with this behavior with more than one of my clients, my argument was I was building their self-esteem. Now, yeah, that's funny and it's sad, but I believed it. That's part of how deep the delusion is. I was amazed that they yanked my license. After that, I taught high school English for almost a year. That school fired me for the same reasons and saw to it in the state of Texas, I'd never bother your children again. Then I became a probation officer. Same firing, same reasons. Then I did what all good alcoholics like I am, who really have no skills. I decided to become a criminal. Met some people in Florida, and we decided to do a little import-export business. And that worked well with me because I detested cocaine. I thought it was the stupidest thing in the world. So I was in that business for 9 months. When my two partners, who were freebasing coke all day long, every day, came to me and said, "You're too dangerous. We can't stay in business with you. You're too erratic with your drinking. You got to go." This morning, I did what I always do when I'm out of town. I got up about 6 and I took a walk. And I walked around the hotel parking lot. I walked around the Denny's parking lot. Went to the hotel behind us, walked around their parking lot. Went up to the truck stop and walked around their parking lot. And for the last number of years, it's been the same sad story. I found one coin in all those parking lots. Now, for me, that's significant with what I want to share with particularly you new people this morning. Sometime you'll hear that back in the day, we had it harder than the kids do today. I promise you, in that amount of walking, 31 years ago, I could have found enough change to get a half a pint of Crystal vodka. You could walk parking lots and find enough money to buy booze. Nobody uses cash today. The poor drunk can no longer find change to buy a bottle of Crystal vodka. When I had to live in my car, I had a Buick Deuce and a Quarter, 71 Buick. That thing was as long as from here to that wall. It was big enough to have company over. You could stretch out in the back seat. I worry about young drunks today having to live in a Kia or something like that. They'll have back trouble the rest of their life. And y'all heard these stories. I am so glad that I got sober before cell phones. I can't hardly stand it. Can you imagine some of the videos that some of these people will have to put up with for the rest of their life? The worst that could happen to me, and it did a time or two, was a Polaroid picture. You young people, Google Polaroid. A lot of things have changed in the 91 years that we're fixing to have of a little history. We're already in it with Bill's sobriety date. It's not very long ago. A lot of things have changed in the culture, and I bet with 49 and 44 and 43, a lot of people talk about what's happened in AA and how it's changed. There's been radical change throughout our history. But I want to share with you what my experience is. Two things have not changed, and they never will change. The illness of alcoholism is exactly the same today as it was on December the 11th, 1934, Bill's dry date. And the program of recovery that's in that big book of Alcoholics Anonymous is still the only program of recovery that I know of that holds out hope and help to masses of people like those of us sitting in this room. The illness has not changed. Recovery has not changed. And I guess a little preaching will happen from time to time. I love the reason out of there is a solution. Read that again sometimes, folks. There is a solution. I've read the whole book at least three times. I never find a second one. There is a solution. And I'm here tonight because on Monday, July 25th of 1994, I ended up in a man's office who I knew was in Alcoholics Anonymous, because he didn't keep his anonymity so secret that people didn't know it. Now, he didn't flash it. He didn't bumper sticker it. But if you were around Joe for an hour, you knew he was sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. So when my day came, I knew a man. I don't know if I could have gone to a room, but I could go to that man. I could tell you hours of drunk logs, but I think describing that wall would be enough. My story is a lot like yours, Tim. In that moment of clarity thing, I was driving back on that Sunday night from my last mother-in-law's home. I'm going through another divorce, which didn't bother me that much. I was used to them. But she had the car that ran, and that bothered me. I'm left with the drunk truck, the transmission's going out of it. Went out that first week. I have to get, it's 4 months before I've got an automobile. And I just hated having to ask these people for a ride. I was so ashamed and so embarrassed. Some of the best friends I've ever had in my life were the people driving up in those old beaters and picking me up. And I've been doing that ever since I got allowed to have a car again. I was never faithful to any of my wives for any period of time. It was just part of my, in the beginning I wanted to say, well, when I drank I was unfaithful. If you're new and you're using drinking as an excuse, quit it. I discovered in here that I do not have the illness of alcohol. I have the illness of alcoholism. I cannot use drinking as an excuse for any of my behavior around lying, messing around, cheating, stealing. Alcohol didn't make me do any of those things. It allowed me maybe the opportunity and some of the false bravado to do it. But everything I ever did, I found out was already in my mind to do before I did it. My first sponsor's wife said, Gary, drunk words are sober thoughts. And that hit me hard for a long time. I believe it's true today. But I'm coming back that night. That day I'd gotten mad, and she still had some stuff at the house, and I'm drinking whiskey and doing two really dangerous things for us. I'm drinking, and I'm thinking. Now, either one of those can be deadly, but in my case, when you combine them, it spells trouble, not just for me, but for everybody around me. She still had some stuff at the house, and I vaguely remember taking what she had and putting it in my luggage of choice, plastic trash bags, writing one of those, F you, you've ruined my life, I'm only going to give you one more chance notes, and putting in there. I didn't know where she was, but I drove over to her mama's house late that night. I remember screaming and cussing and throwing those garbage bags over into her yard. Started home about 6 miles to West Odessa where I live. I've been stopped 3 times in the previous 6 months on that same road. And along that trip, something happened. And I was afraid to talk about it when I came to AA. I was afraid y'all would think I was crazy. I didn't know that you knew I was crazy, and it wouldn't bother you a bit. What happened on that trip is I'm driving, and I heard a voice. Not out loud. This may be controversial, but my first sponsor said, Gary, when you talk to God, that's called prayer. When God talks to you and nobody else, that's called schizophrenia. I'll just throw that out for what it's worth. But the voice in my head simply said, you're not safe. And a kind of terror came over me like I'd never felt before. And I remember pulling off the road. I've got half a bottle of whiskey between my legs. The lights aren't on. I'm probably all over the road. And in that second, I had something happen that I'm glad it happened quick like that. Because my whole life, I'm the guy that would tell you, man, I'm a great dad. I'm a great son. I'm sharp. I'm brilliant. I'm a great business. You know, all this stuff. And in that second, I got to see me suddenly for who and what I really was. It's like my whole life flashed in front of me. And I saw me for the total, absolute loser in life. Every area of life. As a son, as a dad, as a brother, as a husband, as a friend. Total, absolute zero. And it sickened me to see me as I was. And in that second, I knew the gig was up. I knew I was going to have to talk to someone. And I remember this guy, Joe. The way I can explain it or share it with new people, it really is. When I didn't have my first drink until I was 19. My mom asked us promise not to drink when we were in high school, and it may be the only promise ever made and kept. It seemed like out of high school, I had a life that was this big. It was all out there in front of me. And over the years, it just kept shrinking and shrinking and shrinking and shrinking until it got back to where it was that big. And for me, the sadness of that is I never noticed. That's why I don't use denial. I use delusion. And I know what people are saying, and I'm not trying to add to or take away from anyone else's story, but I'm not a guy that would say I had any fun while I was drinking. Because when I look back in the eyes of my children, my mother, those wives, it doesn't seem like much fun anymore. You know, that line in the book about it builds fierce resentment, financial insecurity, and the blameless lives of little children. There's no fun in that for me anymore. And there certainly wasn't any fun in it for them. But I need to tell you the part of the story I want to share. I got to that man's office, told him I thought I might have a drinking problem. He agreed with me. I don't know much of what we talked about, but I know at noon he left his office. He put me in his truck, and he took me to my first meeting. It wasn't his home group. It was the first available meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in that area. And I'm to experience in later years, I'm not just a member of a home group. They taught me to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And in some ways, it's my responsibility for the wellness of all of the groups in my area. Because that might be the one my kid or my grandkid walks into someday. I won't tell you that I belong to the best group in the world, because for me, that would be in some ways putting down the others. And I used to do that a lot. And not many years have I done that. So join AA. I thought I'd live in Odessa forever. I was only there 11 years. And I'm glad I'd been taught to join AA, because when I moved to East Texas, I moved to a place that did not do it right. And I had a sponsor that gave me the same advice he gave me early on. He said, it's your job to pretend like everybody in every meeting you go to is a newcomer. Don't wait for them to come to you. You go to them. And got quite at home in AA pretty quickly, which you can do after a while. That first meeting, I don't remember. I didn't have the DTs the first 20 years of drinking. I had them the last 7 or 8. By the time of that noon meeting, I'm about 10 to 12 hours away from the last drink. I'm starting to vibrate a little bit. I'm not noticing it, but the guy who's going to become my sponsor assigns his pigeons to me. I don't remember it. They took me to my house. While I detoxed, if you stay out there long enough, you lose the insurance, you lose the family support. Texas has no public detoxes, because alcoholism's not a problem in our state. I found out later I was never alone those 4 days. One or more of those guys was with me all the time. They were bringing me to 2 or 3 meetings every day. I was crazy as hell when I found out y'all like us better that way. I love a meeting today when a wet drunk is in the room. That's me. I would presume that's you. And I hope y'all would do what I found out they did in what's going to become my own group. I tell my folks this all the time that I sponsor. You have a newcomer come in, don't change your meeting and have one of those first step meetings. Hopefully they're walking into a group that all that's going on is we're talking about what our problem is and what our solution is every meeting, every day. And we don't have to suddenly change when we've got someone that's new. First of all, they're not going to hear much anyway. And when I go to those meetings where they do make it a first step meeting, most of us are just telling war stories and telling our story, and they still leave the meeting not knowing what's wrong with them. Because if you're like I am, new people, I did not have a clue what was wrong with me when I got here. I've been a well-educated, experienced pastor and therapist. I didn't have a clue about what alcoholism was. I didn't know, and I've never met anybody that did. I had the same experience I imagine that most of you had in my family. They knew what the problem was. What do you think it was, Aaron? What was the problem? No, it was that alcohol. Didn't y'all ever hear that? If you just wouldn't drink, everything would be okay. And I'll get in on that. We had a guy early on that had these little stickers. And he'd give us, put these on your mirror, and it said, you're looking at the problem. And my sponsor said, don't you dare put that up. He said, you're not the problem. God didn't create problems. You're one of God's kids that has a problem. And there's a big difference between being the problem and having a problem. And if you think you are the problem, then secretly deep down, you're going to think you are the solution. You're a man that's got a problem. That problem is not alcohol, it's alcoholism. Now, I've had a chance to visit with a lot of you today and last night. Mike, I haven't met any innocent people that y'all have sobered up here. So far, it seems like you've nailed every one of them I've met. I mentioned when we met at that conference, there are only two kinds of alcoholics. We have convicted felons, we have unconvicted felons. That's it. That's the only two groups of people in these rooms. There's not a dime's worth of difference between the illness that I have, going through all that education and all that really good childhood, and all, not a dime's worth of difference between my illnesses and Tim's illness. Alcoholism is not a competition illness. We're not in here to find out who's the worst. Come on, have you ever known a good one? And thank God it's not a competition recovery. We all have the same illness, and I didn't know what it was. And, you know, I want to have to get sober here right quick because I've got a couple of stories I want to tell. Jerry sat down with me after I quit vibrating. He took me to the restaurant we went to, Cotton Patch Cafe. What I remember that first meeting, he bought me a hamburger. He asked me questions. We talked for 2 hours. He asked me question after question after question. Evidently, I liked talking about myself because I did. He took me a second time, did the same thing. And I swear to you, after those two meetings, he never listened to me again, ever. And I hope you get a sponsor that takes what you say and uses it against you the way Jerry used it against me. And he knew what I'm to find out later, and that all of you who have recovery know this. No alcoholic's going to believe anything because I say it or they read it. I was only going to believe something if I could put that information against my own life experience and say, yeah, that's true for me. So I'm glad Jerry wasn't telling me about his trips to jail or all of the, I don't tell my newcomers about all the divorces and lost careers. If I sat down with somebody like I did last Monday, and I tell them something like, you know, I started drinking in 19. And I thought I had it under control. I was a periodic for the first few years. I didn't let anybody know. My wife didn't know that we'd been married for 3 years that I drank. Because I could plan a trip out of town about every 2 months, go party and raise hell the way I wanted to. I could sober up pretty quick and come home and no harm, no foul. And I didn't notice that over the years that 2 months went to 1 month, went to 3 weeks, went to 2 weeks. And finally, I'm 3 years sober and I walk in the house with some beer because beer is not really drinking. She bawled for an hour while I'm reassuring her. It's just a few beers. I'm a man of the people, blah, 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 blah. And yet we don't hurt anybody but ourselves. That's part of that delusion. But he sat down with me, and I'm telling him about, okay, another divorce. I bump into my liver when I turn around. I don't have any money. The IRS just put me on their amends list. I haven't filed for 8 years. I hate myself for the father I am. My 19-year-old son has already began to treat me the way I treated my dad, telling me exactly what he thought about me. And my daughter would continue to try to call. It's before caller ID and all of that. Any of you old timers remember how you used to get terrified at the telephone? It'd ring and I'd want to pick it up, but it might be my daughter. And I knew I couldn't sound sober enough to convince her I was okay. He listened to all of that and he said, Gary, if you've come in here to get your wife back, hit the door. If you've come in here to get a good job, hit the door. If you've come in here hoping your children are suddenly going to call you dad, the violins are going to play and the birds are going to sing, hit the door. If you're hoping that your health is suddenly going to turn around, hit the door. If you're hoping that the IRS is going, oh, you're in AA, well, forget it. And what I learned later was none of those things that I mentioned were problems. They were consequences. And for you new people, consider this: my whole life, I've been identifying the consequence and trying to fix it, and I never knew the problem that kept spewing them out. And for a long time, I could fix consequences. But as my life shrank, when I finally got to the place that all of you have been to, every alcoholic I've ever met, I'll try it out with you. I started hearing a phrase that I know all of you heard from family and loved ones and maybe employers. What is the matter with you? You ever hear that from anybody? There's something bad wrong with you. What's the matter with you? Now, for our Al-Anon speaker, I started hearing that a long time before I took my first drink. Y'all hear her story? Just crazy as a bed bug. No more sane than any of the other three stories you've heard. New people, Bill's got a line in his little blurb between the two doctors' opinion. Bill writes a couple of paragraphs. And he uses a phrase in there that he used again in the 11th chapter. And it fits all of you members of the Al-Anon family, as well as it does Timmy and Aaron, all alcoholics. The phrase is, it didn't satisfy us to be told that we were outright mental defectives, maladjusted to life, in full flight from reality. Now, Bill says that was true to some considerable extent. But it doesn't make us an alcoholic. Now, as a therapist, I'll tell you, and this may hurt some of you's program, I have met very, 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 very few outright mental defectives in AA. I've never met one of us that was not in full flight from reality and maladjusted to life before we ever took our first drink. And Jerry had got enough of my story that he could talk about that and have me identify it out of my own experience. You've heard a lot of speakers say, I always felt different as a kid. I don't know if I felt different than other kids. I never was thinking about other kids. I had me on my mind all the time. read the medical estimate of AA and in the back of the book, and one of those doctors nails us. He talks about, I'll paraphrase, Alcoholics Anonymous is no temperance society or a crusade. It's alcoholics trying to help other alcoholics. And in this atmosphere, they are able to overcome their excessive over-concentration on themselves. Am I the only one that can identify with that? The difference between Michelle and us Al-Anons is I felt as maladjusted. I had those same kind of feelings. Didn't know it, didn't identify them. But at 19 years of age, on April 21st of 1966, it's a special day, and Texas A&M is also going to be my children's birthday 9 years later. Went to a man's house in San Antonio with his son and a bunch of other Aggies. His dad bought each of us a fifth of whiskey. Mine was Southern Comfort. And on that night, we went out to little Mexican polka clubs. I'm raised in Texas. I've never had a conversation with an Hispanic person. I drank all that Southern Comfort. I drank a lot of beer, and I talked to a bunch of them that night. And something happened that night that I'm not to understand until Jerry began to share it with me. And I really didn't understand it until I've been sober about 4 or 5 years and have been actively sponsoring other men and women in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Something happened that night. I'm the guy that up into that time, I could walk into a club. There could be this many of you ladies sitting at tables by yourself. I cannot walk across the room and ask you to dance. I just can't do it. First of all, I can't dance. And secondly, I'm pretty sure everybody's watching and you're going to say no. Now, you give me about 4 shots of whiskey, I start looking for a woman sitting with her husband and 4 brothers. And the kid can dance. Now, I don't know what you would call that. I could not have called it that until after I got into AA. That was the first spiritual awakening I ever had in my life. Now, I couldn't have put those words to it. But you look at your own experience when you first got drunk intentionally. And it does something so much for me, and I presume for you, than it was doing to me. And in my case, I became the gift to women that quick. And I'm to remain with that until I came to you people. Your story this morning made me think again, and some people think this is crude. I knew if I got in here and even talked to a woman, I'd get drunk. But me being who I am, that couldn't last forever. And I almost screwed myself out of AA the first 2 years. I'm saying that seriously. It would get to the point, well, I can't go to that meeting, she might be there. I can't go to that meeting, she might be there. I bet I've gone to 500 meetings hoping she was there. And I've gone to 501 praying like hell she wasn't there. And before long, I'm having to go to Big Springs or La Mesa or someplace. And I'd gotten a new sponsor, and he sat down with me, and he said, you reminded me of this morning. Let's talk about your ideal future sex life. I said, what are you talking about? He said, it's in that inventory. My first sponsor didn't have me do it. Steve did. And he said, you don't get to talk about what kind of woman you want. You don't get to talk about anything except what kind of man do you want to be made into? And what actions and behaviors will add to that or take away from it? That may be some of the hardest writing I've ever done in my life. And it's not a one and done. As life has gone on, I've changed that a few times. And he had me go, I hadn't shared this in years. You reminded me. He told me, you've got a woman in your life. I was like, am I in blackouts again? You know. Said, your daughter's 22 years old now. Why don't you go build a father-daughter relationship with her? Why don't you get a totally transparent, loving relationship going on with your daughter? Why don't you feel like taking the actions to become a man that's good enough for you to want to be with your daughter before you go and be with other people's daughters? And that changed my life. And I had to tell her what I was doing. That was embarrassing. And in my case, it meant driving every 3 weeks an 800-mile round trip to go spend the weekend with her and talk about these things. I wouldn't take for it today. Well, we got into that, and he helped me see that I'm powerless over alcohol when I drink it. And his question was this simple. Those guys told me the next morning, Kincaid, we don't believe you never drank. You drank us under the table. I was proud of that. My first experience, that's a huge word in here, experience, is I didn't get in a fight. I didn't get arrested. I didn't get sick. I don't guess. I don't remember a minute of the night. But the next morning, I had fun. Because those guys told me I had fun. And they had some of those Polaroid pictures. And I was with women in each one of them. And that's that spiritual awakening that I couldn't have identified. And I've heard enough of your stories. For some of us, it allowed you to just knock out all the pain of some kind of trauma. For others, it allowed you to dream dreams. For me, it allowed me to become a ladies' man, you know. But it did something so awakening and so powerful for me that it didn't do for Michelle, that it didn't do for, there's a lot of maladjusted people out there. I know, because a bunch of them married me. A well person would have ran so quick, so far, so fast, it'd been amazing. We're not the only people that are maladjusted, but it was for me when I look back, Aaron, like when I drank that whiskey, it could reach inside of me wherever the knob was and give it a little twist, and I was adjusted. Now, it's totally delusional, but it's absolutely powerful, and I won't have time to say it, but Aaron said it. I love the way Timmy says, went to a party at 14, came home at 34. It's my just belief today from observations and sponsoring a lot of people, my life and probably your life could not have been any different than it was from the moment of that first drunk until the day you picked up that chip. There's no way it could have been any different except worse. It's like on that day, my life took a direction that led me all the way to July 25th of 94, and all of the education. You know, I wanted to be a good pastor. I wanted to be a good therapist. Evidently, a lot of those people thought I was. But I had alcoholism, and it wasn't going to turn out any other way than the way it did. There is nobody to blame for this illness. How many of you in this room have green eyes? Anybody have brown eyes? Blue, that you hadn't cried the blue out of? You know what? That's just the way it is. I'm an alcoholic. You're an alcoholic. You know what? That's just the way it is. And I always had a lot of trouble with reality, still do from time to time. But there's no shame in being an alcoholic. The only stigma that I've ever found in AA is the stigma that I and each of us bring to it, thinking we know what other people are thinking about us being alcoholics. I'm yet to meet anybody in my time in here that has been harmed by being an active member of AA. If you're new here, I want to tell you AA is a very bad place for alcoholics to visit. It's a move-in job. And the only way I could have moved in, I couldn't do it. I had a sponsor that already lived here, and he was not interested in me taking the steps on my time schedule. He was interested in me taking the steps on his. And we got started on that. And then he asked me about that unmanageable. You know what unmanageable is for me? My kid's 11th birthday. I tell the wife, we're going to play golf. I'll be home, certainly, for the party. I'll bring that stuff. Of course, I came home the next evening. I wasn't going to drink. I was in one of those periods I'm not drinking. Got to the golf course. We're playing golf. Someone offered a beer. Beer's not really drinking. The unmanageable is not the divorces. It's not going to jail. It's not the consequences. The unmanageable is this chronic, progressive, fatal illness I have gets to a point where I can no longer say no to drinking. I am powerless over alcohol when I'm drinking it. That's the craving. But I can't crave it unless it's in my body. And every one of you is like me. I had periods of not drinking that I drank again every time. And I didn't drink out of a craving. I drank out of an obsession, because unmanageable for me means I can't stand life sober all the time. And I can want to be sober, I can promise to be sober, I can try to be sober, but the time always came with a totally sober brain that my mind overrode it and I drank again and the game was on. Step one's a bad step, newcomers. It means if I drink, I'm screwed. If I don't drink, I'm screwed. Step two, I told Jerry, and I'll go through this as quick as I can, because Tim hadn't given me the signal yet. I said, Jerry, we're going to have a little trouble with step two. I've been reading the wall. He said, what's that? And I said, well, I was a franchisee for 14 years. I've been to seminary. I can talk about God in three languages. I've tried that. I know everything there is to know about God, and thank God for a simple man that didn't want to have theology arguments. He didn't want me to go write about what kind of God I had or anything. He says, yeah, Gary, you may know everything about him, but obviously you don't know him. And secondly, with all those degrees, I thought you could read. I said, what are you talking? He said, read the step. And even sitting there right with him, I didn't read it. I said it, and I said it wrong. Step two doesn't say came to believe in. It says came to believe that there's a power greater than ourselves. We're not asking you to believe in anything. Nothing happens in step two. The way Jerry said it to me is, do you believe you're powerless over alcohol? Yes, I've told you that. Do you believe that there's any power in the universe greater than whiskey? And I said, sure. And he said, good, we're on step three. And we were on step three. And 2 days later, we're in the Suburban cleaning the bathrooms before the meeting, which Jerry had all of his newcomers do. I was sober 2 years before I discovered we have full-time janitors there. But he believed it was just as important to hand a newcomer a broom or a mop as it was a big book to get them to being part of things. And he said, you ready to do that third step? And I thought he was talking in general. So I said, yeah. And he said, let's do it. I didn't know he meant then. Because, see, he wasn't on my time schedule. He wasn't taking, well, I just don't know if I'm ready to do that. He knew the right time to do it. And he got over and picked up a big book and knelt down on the floor. And about that time, Alan walked in the room. What are y'all doing? Gary's going to do his third step. Good, I'll do it with you. And he knelt on the floor. I'm a quick study. I knew they didn't want me to bless them. So I knelt on the floor. And he put his finger on that prayer, and I read it as fast as I could, and I got up as quick as I could because my knees hurt, and I was scared to death somebody's going to come in and see me there on the floor with two men and their arms around me. And I'm to discover later that the God y'all have given to me takes my actions a whole lot more seriously than I do. He had me write that fourth step the next Saturday, way too quick. I'd been to enough meetings to know that's too quick. Jerry didn't listen in meetings, I guess, and he put out a big chief tablet. I didn't know for years that he was making fun of me. And a pencil. He said, I'm going to town. I'll be back in a couple hours. We'll do your fifth step. Now, all I'll say about that, I'm not telling anybody that you're doing it right or wrong. That really worked for me. That's how I see the book doing it. I've never met anybody that spent more than 3 hours of their life writing their inventory. Now, I've met a lot of people that stretch that 3 hours out over 5 years. But the actual writing, if you go over 3 hours, you're doing a therapeutic process. We don't have a therapeutic illness, and it's not going to respond to a therapeutic answer. I've got a spiritual illness, and it needs a spiritual answer. And I did that fifth step with him, and I'm not one of those people that just felt the weight of the world. When I went to look at those defects of character and to go over those first five proposals, I got to see in black and white what I felt on the night of the 24th of July, what a loser I was. That's how my life ended up. And in that moment, I knew I was going to need somebody's help to straighten that up. And I got on my knees at that time and got that book out and took that third step prayer after doing the fifth step because Jerry had told me something. I'll say this in 7 minutes. We've got such a practical, pragmatic program. I remember asking him before we're doing that prayer, well, what's God's will for me? You ever hear anybody ask that? Like all the time? Or, I think this is God's will. I'm supposed to date her. I told that to Jerry once. He said, Gary, God's not a pimp. God isn't getting you a woman or a job or a parking space or any of that stuff. You know what God's will is? It says it right there in the book for an alcoholic. God's will for an alcoholic after the third step is write your inventory. That's it. It's not do I stay or get married. It's not do I get... Write your inventory. That's the next thing. What's God's will for me then? Do your fifth step. What's God's will next? How about six and seven? How about writing that eighth step list? God's will for me after that is do the ninth step amends. Now, is that too simple or what? And while I'm doing the ninth step, which, by the way, my sponsor believed in the wherever and not whenever, when I got over, he had a bigger eight-step list than I did. And he wrote them out on 3x5 cards and gave me 3 a week. We rehearsed them and I did them. And I could talk for 2 days about the power of step 9. My whole life lives on the ninth step today. I'll just tell you, new people owed $142,000. I could never get that repaid. And he just said, if you can steal it, you can pay it back. And 16 years later, I had it paid back. Because that reading that I had Mike do, it says, if you persist. Persisting is real big in here. Those children that I had abandoned, by the way, didn't just say, oh, Daddy, It was about 7 years before my son would even speak to me. It was 13 years before we were finally like kittens. 7 years and 13 years is not too late or not too long to wait for something that was never going to happen. And during that time, he called me names. He let me know. I never had the right to say, you can't talk to me that way, or I need to set boundaries. For me, we don't have boundaries in here. We have directions in here. And if I follow those directions, they're going to set some boundaries. And my kid have every right to say what he said to me the whole time. When I'm 9 years sober, that daughter gave me a call and said, what are you doing in September? Well, I knew I was going to be at a roundup in Abilene, but I knew better not to tell her that. And she said, the baby's due that week. Jay's going to be on a buying trip. Can you come spend the first week with me when I bring the baby home from the hospital? That's nothing special about me. That's the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that comes from sitting down first, making that direct amends, listening, and not believing it's an apology, not believing we're suddenly going to be wonderful, believing it's the beginning of me trying to live in such a way that over time they will know that I am a changed or amended person. And from then on, it's my job to practice these principles in my relationships with my children and my brother and all those folks. And the story I'll end with, I'd like to tell more, but I've got 9 months. I've got a job. Got a little money in my pocket. I'm on about my third girlfriend. I've got a transmission in that old drunk truck. I'm one of the most spiritual people in all of West Texas. Nobody else seconded that, but I knew it. But some of the fire's starting to go out. Again, newcomers, we've got good news and bad news. The good news is that AA works. And the bad news is that AA works. And you can come in here and live off of the symphony of the music of the fellowship and of getting to know good friends and going to the coffee shop, making a lot of meetings, and maybe start to think you did it. And maybe if you're like me, you go home at night and the squirrel cage is starting to go around again. And I'm starting to wonder, is there not something more? Maybe I need more. And I found out because within a couple of weeks, a man asked me to sponsor him. And that's always the more I've needed in AA. I'll hear people say, I need more God. That third step tells me I have never and I will never in my life need more God. I have always and I always will need less me. And if I can find ways to get me out of the way, all that's left is God. We alcoholics are greedy people. We've already admitted in the chapter to the agnostic that God is either everything or he's nothing. And I'm the guy that wants more of everything, thinking I needed something added to my life. This guy asked me to sponsor him. I said, yes, I'm wanting him to get it so bad I can't hardly stand it. Sorry about the time. I'll finish here. He's living with a daughter that doesn't want him there. He doesn't want to be there. He can't drive anymore. He's about 70 years old, going back because of another DWI. I'm picking him up, taking him to meetings. I'm going to his daughter's house a couple times a week. We're in that book. I'm wanting this man to get it so bad I can't stand it. And we're on page 68 about the fifth week. I'll never forget it. It's the fear inventory. In that fear inventory, it's got a phrase, we're here to play the role as he assigns it. And I looked across at that man and I said, good God Almighty, Gary, you're sitting across the kitchen table from your daddy. There wasn't a dime's worth of difference in this man's behavior and his whole life and my dad. I made amends to my dad, but sometimes out on the porch, daddy's still that SOB. Sometimes the children's mother's still that bitch. Can you believe that? And her parents and all that stuff. And it came to me in that moment. I'm here to play the role as he assigns it. I'm wanting this guy to get it so bad I can't stand it, but my dad's an SOB. And right above that, it says we're now on a different basis of trusting and relying on God. I had to ask the question, what does that look like? It doesn't look like, oh, I trust God. I'm just going to give it to God. We don't give nothing to God. I don't. I turn it over to the care of God. All that I really turn over is the outcomes. They told me if you're going to get out of the driver's seat and let God drive, your life's going to wreck because God ain't a chauffeur. I have to take those actions. And I knew in that second I had to take an action about my daddy. And I knew that words are actions. I was going to have to rename him. I could no longer call him SOB. I at first called him a still suffering alcoholic. It came out hard. And after a few months, I'm calling him Daddy. Because another thing happened in that time. I got a new sponsor. He said, your dad's in that nursing home. How often do you go see him? I don't. I don't like the smell. I really don't like him. He said, you're going to go 3 times a week and help your brother out. And he gave me this action, which may be the thing in my life I never wanted to do more than I've never wanted to not do something in AA. I walked into Daddy's room, and when I came in, he'd always say, you little SOB, get me out of here. All you want is my stuff. And I had his stuff. But I walked in with a rag and some shaving cream and some lotion and a razor, got that towel hot and almost had to fight Daddy the first time, put that towel on his face and put that lather on him, and I shaved my daddy. I pulled those old feet out from under the sheet and sawed off his toenails and quickly put on some lotion on him. About the third time I walked in, Daddy didn't say, you little SOB, he'd just go, he loved that hot shave. And after a couple of months, I'm putting lotion all over his body. He never changed. I really never did anything except I just touched my daddy. Because I learned how that role I'm here to play, again, is about words. That is not my daddy. I'm his son. Those are not my children. I'm their father. That's not my brother. I'm his brother. That's not my job. I'm their employee. And with your help, I can live that way. All I'm concerned about is my behavior being the best dad, kid, son, brother I can be. And whatever they do or don't do is none of my business. Because out of that, I learned about that ninth step that all it really says is you repay love with love, you repay hate with love, and you repay money with money. Keep it that simple, and your life will be changed. I had to change the children's mother name. She hadn't been my ex-wife in over 30 years. She's the children's mother. That's the children's grandparents and aunts and uncles. I live in Sulphur Springs, Texas today because that's where both those children live. That's where all that family lives. And I live there because of the grace of God through this program that gave me a new life where when it came time to close to retirement, the children insisted this is where I'm going to live. And again, that's the program of AA. It's not me. I'll end with this story. I never had sponsorships that asked me to write a gratitude list, and I'd never written one. And about 20 years sober, I was visiting with my sponsor, And something came up, and I don't know where it came from, but driving home, I realized, you know, I did write a gratitude list. It's called my 8th step list. My children were on there. My daddy was on there. My mother was on there. My brother was on there. All of those family were on there. The man that had abused me was on there. The churches, everything that was on that 8th step list allowed me to look at it that day and look at that promise. We will not regret the past, nor wish to shut the door on it. And that comes from doing this work and listening to Aaron's story, our dark past in God's hands. Well, how do I put my life in God's hands? The steps. Follow the dictates of higher power. That's the steps. Allow things to come to you, Gary. Quit trying to go get them. And what I learned or experienced is I've never needed more. God's math is addition by subtraction. I needed things removed, not things added. Y'all called them resentments and fears and harms done to others. I didn't need to find a new way to get close to God. I need to listen to Bill Wilson and his story. The alcoholic that wants to perfect and enlarge their spiritual life does through work and self-sacrifice for others. I've discovered this isn't a program for me. It's a program for everybody that's ever lived under my roof or ever will. It's not a program about what I get. It's a program about what I try to give. How sick is that? For people like us. And nobody does it well, folks. On a good day, I get a C+. I don't know anybody on the A honor roll in AA. But when I do that evening review, which I do 350 days out of the year, people, it's an open book test. It's not that hard. And I look at my day, try to correct the things I can, and because God grades on the curve of grace, I get a little smiley face on the day, retire the day, and I get to awaken in the morning to ask my boss what I pray every morning. Good morning, boss. What can I do for you today? For what y'all did for me, I could not be more grateful. And Mike, all of you, thank you for allowing me to be here.